Hello, everyone, and welcome to the Revolution 250 podcast. I'm Bob Allison. I chair the Rev 250 Advisory Group. And our guest today is Gene Procno. Gene Procno had a distinguished career in business, but now he's really turned to his real vocation, which is the history of the revolution. So, Gene, welcome to the podcast.
Thank you, Bob. I'm looking forward to our conversation.
So am I. And you've just published a fascinating book, William Hunter, Finding Free Speech, A British Soldier's Son Who Became an Early American. Now, there's a lot there in that title. And so let me just say, William Hunter's father was a sergeant in the British Army, and he spends much of his childhood then in America with the British Army and as a prisoner of war with the British Army. And so it's a great story. So tell us a bit about, if you could give us a nutshell of who William Hunter was and then how you found this diary.
Okay. I would use the word serendipity first to say how we found the diary. I basically was at a dinner party. And if you know how you go to a dinner party when you don't know people, they always sit you next to someone you don't know, you know. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, they asked what I do. And I said, well, I'm an emerging historian. And she said, well, we have a diary in our family collection. We don't know much about it. We think it's around the revolutionary era. Would you like to look at it? And boy, did I jump at that opportunity. Wow, yeah. And so what I found was a 35-page diary written in beautiful 18th century handwriting. But it was missing the first couple pages in the diary. And it was some sections were missing. And there was no name in the diary. So I had to figure out who that person was. Basically, what was a discovery process in writing this book was discovering that the diary author was William Hunter and that he was the son of a British soldier. So it was a very much of a discovery process here around the diary itself.
Right. So they had the diary, but they weren't quite sure whose it was?
No. And in fact, the family's name is not Hunter today. And so basically what I had to do was to create a genealogy from William Hunter to the people that are living today, which I've done. Now, it's not published in the book for, you know, privacy reasons, but I'm very sure that this diary is authentic because of that. And they've had the diary in their custody for the whole time.
Hunter has kind of an interesting career after the war. He becomes a journalist, publishes edits newspapers in Western Pennsylvania and then in Kentucky, and he becomes an auditor with the Treasury, a banker. He goes bankrupt a couple of times in his different business ventures. But I think the thing that really interests, we can talk about all of that, but the thing that really interests us is his father is a sergeant in the British Army, and so his mother and young William and some of the other siblings are traveling with the British Army through much of the campaigns.
Yes. And in the 18th century, the British Army, when they deployed overseas, many of the families went with the soldiers on these deployments, because these deployments are not like they are today. They could be 10 years or more deployments. And so the family went with these soldiers, and William's parents went to America from Ireland, where they his father enlisted in the army. By the way, his father was a Protestant, because at that time the Catholics were not allowed in the British Army, right, even though he was from Ireland. So he was an Irish Protestant. Mm-hmm. And he came to America. He was first stationed in Brunswick, New Jersey, which is now New Brunswick, New Jersey. Mm-hmm. And William was born there. So he was born to British. He was born British in America.
Yeah. Wow. Okay.
And then later in life, he'll say he's an American because he was born in America.
That's right. Yeah. And it seems like it's kind of a sensitive thing for him. You make a point that he's really not saying my father was a British soldier.
Yeah, because when he moved back to the United States after the war, you know, it really wasn't that cool to be a British person, because we fought against the British. And he actually went and lived in Western Pennsylvania and in Eastern Kentucky. And both those places were populated by Revolutionary War veterans, basically people that got pensions, you know, and got land for those pensions. And so he was living among people that fought against his father. and a heavy concentration of them. So he didn't want to advertise that he was the son of a British soldier. Yeah. And in some cases, when he became politically active and that fact got out, it was used against him and was used to impugn his loyalty, for which I don't think is the case. I believe he became a loyal American. He served nine presidents in Washington, so he was a loyal American. But people back there discriminated against him because of his British heritage.
How so? That would be some of the ways he would have been discriminated against.
Well, what they would say is that he wasn't a loyal American. You know, he lived through the War of 1812. He was a militia officer at the beginning of the war. He was a major in the Kentucky militia, he basically resigned that commission when the fighting upbroke, he did not volunteer. At that time, you volunteered for the militia to go into battle. He did not volunteer. I believe it was not because he wasn't loyal or he didn't want to fight against the British. I believe it was because he had saw so much war and so much carnage as a child that he just didn't want to go to war. I mean, it was he had some horrific experiences as a child during the revolution, and I don't think he wanted to repeat those.
You can understand that, and you describe some of them, or he described some of them kind of in his memoir, and you've gone into more detail about some of the things he sees in his time with the army.
Yeah, his father was during one of the opening battles of the war took place on the border of Canada and the United States at a place called Fort St. John or Fort St. Jean in French. His father was a defender of that fort when it was under siege by Patriot General Richard Montgomery. The Patriots lobbed cannonballs into the fort. One of those cannonballs hit a powder keg that was sitting next to John Hunter, William's father. It exploded and egregiously burned his father. And, you know, burns today are egregious. Back then, they were really egregious. Yeah. And so he could not, he really couldn't be moved. And so after the fort was taken, William spent the winter in Canada when his father was convalescing. And back then, again, as families traveled with soldiers on campaign, they also traveled with soldiers into captivity. His father entered a POW camp, William and his mother and brother followed him into camp. So he saw that. He saw a disease. He went through smallpox epidemics. He was inoculated against smallpox. He actually became a smallpox carrier for doctors.
Because he had a case, so they would take him to other people.
They would take him to other people. And I actually think he did that to earn money. I mean, at that time, it was if you had to live on the rations of a prisoner, I mean, basically rations were for a soldier were cut in half for the soldier's wife and cut in three quarters for a soldier's son. So that wasn't very much to eat. So they had to supplement what they the basic rations, and they needed money for clothing and other living expenses. So I think he did that for that. But he saw a lot of death and destruction. He also, when he went into captivity the second time on a ship going back to England, he was the ship was attacked by a French privateer. And he saw a British officer's leg got shot off with a cannonball and a bunch of other deaths there. And then his father was also injured there. And so he spent a year in captivity in France, much of that in a French hospital, watching his father convalesce.
How old is he at this time when he's going through all of this?
He's an early teenager, you know, so he's... he's a very precocious kid. He had to grow up pretty quickly. This guy was not, he didn't have your normal childhood of being able to go to a school and have playtime and playmates. He had to probably to help out the family with their subsistence right from an early age.
Well, we're talking with Gene Procknow, who is the author of William Hunter, Finding Free Speech, a British soldier's son who became an early American, and really focusing on the journal that William Hunter wrote later in life, recounting many of these experiences he had during the time of the Revolution as he's observing this. So there's never really a push to get him into the army, or is the war over by the time he would have been old?
Oh, that's an interesting question, because he went back to England in 1779. So the war was still going on. His father basically was worn out. Between the wounds, he wasn't able to campaign, and so they sent him back on a recruiting mission. So William spent several years traveling around the West Midlands area on a recruiting soldiers to come back to the 26th Regiment of Foot in the United States. William became a middle teenager in the 15-16 time frame, he basically had to earn a living. His father wanted him to be a soldier and go into the army.
Yeah.
His mother said, no way. You know, and William in his diary talks about, he just went, I'm so glad that didn't happen, because he just didn't want to do that. And so he became apprenticed to a printer. And back then you had to pay someone to be an apprentice. You just didn't sign up to be an apprentice. And I believe that his father funded that with some of the recruiting fees that he earned by recruiting soldiers. And that's how William was fortunate enough to become an apprentice printer.
And that really does lead to a career as an editor and both in Britain and America.
Yeah, he works for a couple of printers in Britain, and he becomes very intellectually active. In the West Midlands at that time, there was a Dr. Joseph Priestley, who was what they call a dissenting preacher, who dissented from the Church of England, was a Protestant dissenter, and also he was the inventor of club soda and oxygen. And so that was a big
oxygen.
So he did that. But he was also a philosopher, and he was believed in free speech. And because of his non-standard religious beliefs, he was persecuted, and a mob came and destroyed his house, destroyed all of his scientific apparatus. And, William, being a disciple of his and a student of his, just said, this is not the place I want to live. So he really moved to the United States for free speech. Joseph Priestley, they did move to the same place, but they both moved to Pennsylvania.
Right. And so Priestley is also one of the reasons for the Alien and Sedition Acts in 1797 and 98.
Yes. So that's the ironic part. So William Hunter moves to the United States for free speech. And then within a couple of years, the Adams administration and Congress passed the Alien and Sedition Acts, which restricts free speech. And one of the most notable things, though, that Hunter did in his publishing career was he published the first editorial opposing the Alien and Sedition Acts within 2 weeks of doing that.
Wow.
That is an amazing thing to do, because it was very gutsy. It was very courageous to do that, because the penalties for opposing that act were draconian for the person, their family, and their business. Basically, you would lose everything. And district attorney for Pennsylvania and the district attorney for Kentucky both wrote letters to Timothy Pickering, who was the Secretary of State at the time, who was in charge of enforcing the act, recommending that William Hunter be prosecuted for crimes against the state. And Pickering is a smart person. He's also a Massachusetts person from Salem.
Yes, he is.
He said, no, we're not going to prosecute him, because I don't think a jury in Kentucky would convict William Hunter. So they decided to use their first test case against Matthew Lyons in Vermont, where they thought they could get a friendly jury to convict, which is what happened. So yes. William Hunter was not convicted. Mm-hmm. They convicted 26 other newspaper editors, but it was still a very courageous thing. He had no idea that he was not going to be convicted of that.
Right. Yeah. And even though Lyons was convicted, he's reelected to Congress while he's in jail.
Yes, he was. And actually, then he ended up moving to Kentucky. Right, and he actually ended up having some political differences with William Hunter. So,
is that right?
It was a small world back then. I guess it's a small world today, too.
That's true. Yeah. He did say, just to go back briefly to his time in the Revolution, when he talks about his time in Normandy as the happiest of his life. I wonder if you can tell us a little bit about what he's doing there during the Revolution.
Yeah, I mean, he actually learned French, which really helped him. He didn't really learn too much French when he was in Montreal, but he did learn a lot more as a kid. When he was in the hospital, he got to observe kind of what soldiers did for recreation. And a lot of them, they told stories, like they would tell the stories of the Arabian Nights to each other. And that's pretty unique. We don't really know that much about that. But he ended up having more free range. And when he was incarcerated in the United States, in Lancaster, Pennsylvania, he actually really was incarcerated. Here it was really he was in an area that he could move around. He could go out in the countryside. It wasn't like he was penned into a certain stockade.
He's actually kind of a prisoner of war, but he's allowed to roam around.
Yeah, it's like a parole. And one really notable story, which is, was hard. It's hard to figure out whether it was true or not, but I believe it is true. Is because his mother, gained a lot of expertise in treating burn wounds because of treating his father, and she was friendly with a French aristocrat, and that French aristocrat's daughter got burned really badly, and so she cared for that daughter and was able to nurse her back to health. And as a thank you, they invited her to a big gala dinner that was held for Lafayette's benefit. While Lafayette was in Normandy preparing for an invasion of England. And so I believe that actually happened in Lafayette's papers. There are several dinners that he went to in his honor that were attended by British soldiers and British officers.
Interesting.
So it's highly likely to be true.
Yeah. Does he encounter Lafayette when Lafayette comes back to America in the 1820s? Do you know?
Yes, he does. The historical record's a little thin on that. They went to Lafayette came to Frankfort, Kentucky, where William Hunter lived. We do know from the tax records that or the town records that William's wife prepared food for the event. Mm-hmm. William Hunter was not one of what they call managers of the event. Mm-hmm. Usually they have the town trustees would be called managers of the event. Mm-hmm. And he was not one of those, but I suspect I'm really sure he went because of his wife's involvement, demonstrated involvement of that. So it would have been lovely to be a mouse in that room to hear what they had to say. But unfortunately that's not in the historical record.
That's fascinating. We're talking with Gene Procknow about his book on William Hunter and finding free speech in early America. And it's a tremendous memoir. It's about 37 pages initially.
Yep.
Why? So he's in his 80s when he sits down to write it or so. Why does he decide to do this, do you think?
Well, because it only covers the first 25 years of his life. Mm. And so it kind of abruptly ends.
Yeah.
One thing is that, it potentially he was ill, right? And he just got that bar, right? That is something that is. We do know that the diary was written after 1830. because he references a King Louis the, oh, I forget his last, what is it, 18th? 18th, I think. He was a, he took refuge in the Edinburgh Holyrood Castle from the French revolutionaries. We know that he lived there in 1830. So we know it's written after 1830. Okay. I think that part of this was that he had suppressed talking about his previous life because he wanted to be, you know, didn't want to be discriminated against and he wanted to be an American. But I think later in life, he wanted his family to know the true story and he wanted to get the true story of his background out. And so I think that's really why he wrote this diary. And I think that's why the family kept it. Kept it in the family because it was something that described their father, grandfather, great grandfather's activities that really wasn't that well known to the family.
Right, and so he's married. He has children who also then are Americans.
Yes. Yeah. Yes, and his children. He had two that died from some illness very early on. We know it was not smallpox because we know they were inoculated against smallpox, but it was some illness. They died very early on. He had two daughters and a son. Son and the youngest daughter predecease him, and only one child lived longer than he did. And the family kind of moved south moved into the deep south and became Confederates. It's a pretty unique passage that takes, it's not so much about William, but about his wife, Anne Hunter. Who, by the way, I think they had a great marriage. But anyway, she and I've tried to find her much about her in the historical record. But like a lot of women back then, there wasn't as much. There is one thing that she went to North Carolina during the Civil War, 1864, and I believe it was to nurse a great grandchild. To health or to bury a grandchild, either one. We don't know exactly which, because there was two. And then she went with her daughter down there. And coming back into D.C., you had to pass through the Union lines. Mm-hmm. And there were Union soldiers, and so they held her up and until they could verify who she was and she wasn't a spy. And so, believe it or not, that pass, so that decision went all the way up to Abraham Lincoln. Wow. And in Abraham Lincoln's papers, there's a pass signed by Abraham Lincoln that says the old lady can pass, but not the young one.
Oh, wow.
I mean, can't you just imagine Abraham Lincoln saying that? Right. I mean, so believe it, that went all the way up to the president for final adjudication. Yeah. So she did pass. I think they had a very, very good marriage. By this time, Anne Hunter was a widow. William had passed in 1854 at the age of 86. And he worked to the last. He worked to the last day, Bob. He worked as the he worked in the Treasury Department as an auditor in the Treasury Department. He served nine presidents. He never got a pay raise. By the way, he was paid $1,200 a year from when he started in 1832, and in 1854, he never got a pay raise through that whole time. In fact, the only thing he got was the last 2 years. He got a pay reduction of $200. It wasn't very lucrative to work for the government at all.
A different kind of federal bureaucracy then.
Yes, it was. It was, but he did. He served a lot of. He helped uncover a lot of fraud, his job was in the Navy Department. And there was fraud such as the the captain of the ship would be, this might be interesting for your, constitution, work, but, the, captain of the ship would buy firewood at $1 a cord and sell it to the Navy at $1.30 at a cord.
Right,
and so he figured out that that wasn't, that wasn't what you're supposed to be doing.
Those guys weren't very well paid either. So.
No, they weren't either. So but they were making a little on the side. So
but he he's not doing that. His role is blooded.
No. So he was, in fact, that's the other thing is that they ended up, firing, several of the auditors for fraud, during his tenure. And, he was instrumental in those investigations. You know, he came to Washington under the aegis of Andrew Jackson. He was a Jacksonian supporter, big-time. And this was the first time that they really fired people from the bureaucracy for both political purposes and malfeasance. And so there, in the book, describes both.
We're talking with Gene Procno about his book on William Hunter, Finding Free Speech in Early America. And he has this an interesting career as starting with newspapers. And you make this point that one thing that needed to keep a newspaper going was having some big story to write about when there wasn't some big call. A lot of the papers fail because why is someone going to keep reading this if there's nothing exciting going on? It's really a different time in journalism as we think about it. Maybe not such a different time.
Yeah, you know, back then, the you're right, big stories. They had a huge story he worked on that was Aaron Burr, the treason of Aaron Burr. Mm-hmm. You know, Aaron Burr was first prosecuted for treason in Frankfort, Kentucky, where William Hunter lived. Paper that he actually was a competing paper that he actually printed. So he printed two papers, his own paper and a paper for his competitor. So and they broke a story about Aaron Burr's treason, the treason of several other prominent Kentuckians. And that story became a blockbuster, and it created a huge faulty role. And so he that did help him. However, the printing business wasn't all that profitable back then in the publishing, and he really needed to be a state printer. He was a state printer for Kentucky for 10 years, and he also had to be very partisan. He started out with being a kind of a middle-of-the-road editor, found out you don't do that. You either become one side or the other. And his personal political beliefs were more Jeffersonian or Jacksonian. Mm-hmm. So he picked that side, not the Federalist side. Mm-hmm. You really had to be very partisan. In fact, he started a newspaper in Louisville, Kentucky, called the Louisville Gazette. He started it just for Andrew Jackson's campaign. And when Andrew Jackson's campaign was over, the paper was defunct. He's closed down the paper. So it was just really there to support Andrew Jackson's candidacy.
It's interesting because, of course, the big power in Kentucky politics at the time was Henry Clay, who was Jackson's arch opponent.
Yes.
And so he seems to have chosen the right side, though.
He did. And Henry Clay was not a huge supporter of William Hunter, but he did recommend William Hunter's paper to people like James Madison and other people. So, as being our authoritative here. So they didn't really have a great relationship. Henry Clay was more worried about dueling and things like that. And so those filled the cover. I think Hunter liked the stories that Clay created here, so that he could publish them and create some notoriety for his paper.
Yeah, it makes good copy, I think they would say.
Yes, in the newspaper. Makes good copy. Yes.
Yeah, we're talking with Gene Procno, the author of William Hunter, Finding Free Speech, a British soldier's son who became an early American. And another of your projects has been this wonderful website database on researching the American Revolution. I wonder if you can tell us how you created this and what it is, so folks can find it and use it.
Yes, it's a website. It is www.researchintheamericanrevolution.com, kind of all scrunched together. What I found was that as I started doing my research, I found that there wasn't a site that described primary and secondary sources for events and people of the revolution. And it was kind of there's lots of great sites for articles on the revolution, like the Journal of the American Revolution and other sites, but no place where a student or a researcher can go to find out kind of the historiography, to use a historian term, about events and people. And so basically that's what it is. There's a page on the website for all the major events of the revolution and all the major characters of the revolution. Mm-hmm. And it basically provides primary and secondary sources for those people. And so it'd be like a first stop going there. It's a bit different than like a Wikipedia, where it just describes those events and those people. Yep. This gives you the roadmap where to go to do research on the people.
Yeah, it's really very, very good, because it does, it's a guide to studying the revolution with what are the good sources on it.
Yeah, and I try to add, in some places we've in some places I've added kind of some verbiage to say, what are the best sources? What are the sources that are the most authoritative? Which ones maybe to stay away from? Yeah. And kind of what are the newest sources? Because with the revolution, some of the newest sources tend to be better than the 19th century sources, which tend to have more embellishments associated with them and a little bit better researched with our internet today. It's a labor of love. It's one of those things that will never be finished, Bob, because it always will have new things. There's so many new books that are published each year. Yeah. So
you've written a number of reviews of books too that you published in the Journal of the American Revolution and other places, which has been very, very judicious way of looking at the books.
Yeah. To me, one of the best things to do is that one of the best things, readers, if you don't really into it all the time, reading a review is really a great way to be introduced to a book. And because I think that way you're more of a discerning reader. And that's my goal in a review, is to make a reader more discerning. It isn't really to describe the book, or it's not to criticize the book, or make the it's really there to help a reader kind of decode the book and get the most out of it.
We're talking with Gene Procknow about his book William Hunter and his website on researching the revolution. Now, you had a career in business world, consulting and international things. And then in your retirement, you've turned to this. You've actually just earned a master's degree from Norwich University in history. And I'm wondering if you always had an interest in history, or if this is just something that you woke up one day and said, hey, I want to be an historian.
Well, the way I always say, Bob, is that history is my second job, but my first passion. And so, from a William Hunter's age that he started, I've been always interested in history. So it really has been my first passion. Getting back to that has been really good. I really believe that doing history research is very akin to what I did in business. I was a business advisor, for which I had to kind of figure out how things worked and what were people's motivations and why people were doing what they were doing. That's kind of what a historian does, right? They have to go back and figure out, why did this happen, right? And so it's really very similar to what I did as a business consultant, business advisor. You mentioned Norwich University. They have a wonderful program in masters in American history, and I really recommend that. It's been really good. One of the things I found is that no matter how much experience you have, someone has more, and that's what you learn from. That's what you learn from. So that's what I found was very, very, very helpful.
That's great. That's great. Now, do you have another project now that you've finished with William Hunter?
Well, I'm doing some work on a American Revolution General Charles Lee, who was very, very controversial, and he's been kind of viewed as by some as a traitor, some as a patriot, some as a kind of a weak general, some as a very strong general. Mm-hmm. You know, it's been kind of all over the map, and I've got some new ideas around him I think that he's been misunderstood. You know, like it's kind of funny because people have dismissed him because they said he loved dogs better than people. That's what John Adams said. He loves dogs better than people. And I'm saying today he fit right into today's society. Everybody loves dogs more than they love people, right? So, today. So anyway, I think there's a lot more to him than has been uncovered today. So that's my next project, and we'll see. I'm hoping to get some things published on that shortly.
Good. Well, maybe we could have you come back on to talk about Charles Lee.
Oh, I'd love to. He's a fun guy to talk about.
He is. So we've been talking with Gene Procknow about his book on William Hunter, Finding Free Speech, and his website, Researching the American Revolution. And I want to thank you for joining us and coming out to talk. And you've been a fairly regular listener, too, I understand.
Oh, absolutely. I listen to Apple all the time. I'm on my way walking to the gym. That's what I do.
that's great. And, you know, we have listeners actually all over. So I want to thank this week our listeners in Kaohsiung in Taiwan and in Tel Aviv and in Decatur, Georgia, Dorchester, Massachusetts, Mumbai, and Minas Gerais or Belo Horizonte in Brazil, and Williamson, West Virginia, and all places in between. If you're in one of these places, send Jonathan Lane an email, jlane@revolution250.org, and I'll send you one of our Revolutionary 250 lapel pins or our magnets, which we just come out with. So thank you to Jonathan Lane. Thank you again, Gene, for joining us.
Thank you for the opportunity.
And now we'll be piped out on the road to Boston.